second being the prophet and the one that receives the revelation and is the one that is the connection to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in that sense. So I'm not saying team as equals.
No.
They're not a team of equals.
No.
The prophet is...
The prophet.
The prophet and way above, you know, the imam. But it was the combination of the two that was able to, you know, bring Islam.
Yes.
And in a sense, the way that Allah has planned it is that Imam Ali took over those functions or many of those functions that a prophet might have to do, but which might repulse some people from the prophet. Because the point of the prophet is to attract.
Yes.
More than to repulse. It doesn't mean that they don't repulse.
No, but it was more to attract.
Right. Because there is a natural repulsion of people who don't want to accept truth. This has nothing to do with the personality of the person.
No.
If any a person with any personality is standing up for truth, there are going to be people who are repulsed by that or who will be his enemies.
His enemies, yes.
Because that's the nature of truth.
Yes.
Truth is the thing that distinguishes itself.
That's right.
From other things. This is the nature of truth.
Well, I mean, there's an Arabic saying for this kind of thing. It says truth is bitter.
Right. Exactly. It's in English as well. We have the bitter truth, whatever.
Exactly.
It's the thing that differentiates.
Sheets.
Distinguish in the sense of distinguishing from this from that.
Exactly.
This is, you know, you get to a point where this is no longer the case.
Mm.
The facts no longer are this.
Yes.
These are the facts.
Yes.
Okay? So this is going to cause problems for some people.
It will.
So, we discussed Imam Khomeini's personality as a polarizing figure in that context. In the sense of, and let's be very clear, and repeat what we're saying, that as a fully immersed, excellent student of the Prophet, peace be upon him, and Imam Ali alayhi salam,
yes,
he is a reflection of the personality of his guides and teachers.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
Leaders.
Exactly.
He is like Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Mm.
So, as Imam Ali, his personality was one that attracted many and repulsed many.
Exactly.
Exactly like his mullah. Exactly like his imam.
Exactly.
Okay? So, this is what we were saying in terms of this characteristic of, and we also said, and this is important to point out, that anyone who really is a mu'min is going to have aspects of this in their character, characteristic.
They certainly will.
Right?
Certainly
in their personality.
Will.
Or it's going to have aspects of this.
Hmm.
Some more, some less.
Hmm.
You cannot be a mu'min and not have enemies. Let's be very clear about that.
Mm.
You cannot be a mu'min and not have enemies. You are going to at least have at least one enemy. And people say, well, is that something you made up? I said, look in the Quran. It says, for every prophet, we have sent an enemy.
Exactly.
So if you're a follower of that prophet, you're going to have enemies.
Quite.
This is something, it's not, you know, God is giving us is informing us of a reality. When he says that in the Quran, he's informing us of a reality. For every prophet, we sent an enemy. So if you're a follower of that prophet, you're going to have enemies. If you're not,
quite,
you might not have enemies. And this brings us to a very, very important subject, which is something that we need to discuss as believers, as a community, as believing Muslims, which I think has been a major, major problem in the Muslim community. And that is that we have a very distorted and, I believe, wrong understanding of what it means to be a holy person.
Now, that's a point I wanted to raise as well, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, because when you talk about holy people, there's a false image out there that somehow a holy guy is nice to everyone. That's not what being holy is about, is it?
Well, I would say, in principle, what you're saying is right. The point of being a holy person is not that you are somehow, you know, blissfully, you know, riding, you know, a foot above the ground and, you know, everything that around you turns into flowers.
Flowers and all that kind of thing, yeah.
That's not what it is.
Yeah.
Okay?
And somehow Satan can sing from the same hymn sheet as yourself.
Right. The whole point of religion, and I mean religion in the larger sense of religion, those religions that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has revealed, you know, time of existence of humanity.
Sure.
They are there as a source of distinguishing humans, not as necessarily getting everyone together.
That's right. It's distinguishing them, isn't it?
It's about distinguishing. It's
differentiation.
Distinguishing,
we're talking
about. Not in a racist way, not in a
it's based on merit,
chauvinistic
isn't it?
Way in the sense of. And this is one of the main arguments that the people who are against religion will say about religion. Religion divides people.
Yes.
Religion causes wars. Religion causes evil. Religion encourages the base instincts of people.
Mm.
And I'm sure that religions have done this in history.
Of course they have.
Because people are involved with religions.
Of course they
have. So the people that are involved in religions do this.
Yes.
It could even be me. I'm not saying that.
Yeah.
You know, this is distinguished from the issue of what the job of religion is.
Mm.
The job of religion is to distinguish people. Based on one basis, those who accept the truth and try to act on it in their life,
yes,
and those who reject it and fight it. Okay, I said it in a very general way because I don't want it to, this is a universal matter, whether it was, the revelations that were given to the older prophets and the prophets before Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, or whether it's the revelation that was given to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, which is the first universal and the final revelation.
Sure.
It's there to distinguish people. It's not about everybody getting together and,
singing Kumbaya.
Exactly. It's not about that.
No.
For God's sakes.
I mean, this is the thing.
It doesn't mean you treat other people badly. It doesn't mean
them. No.
It doesn't mean that you don't live with them. It doesn't mean that you don't cooperate in certain matters.
No.
Okay? But it's not about everybody. Oh, everybody's the same. Everybody's just as good. Oh, go kiss the hand of the person who just stole from you. Oh, go.
And slap me on the other cheek, that kind of thing. No, that's not what it's about. No.
So, when somebody understands this reality of religion and starts acting on that, obviously they're going to polarize.
Well, the thing is that what's more polarizing, I would say, is, one of the principles that we have in Islam, which, is even difficult for even Muslims to act upon with other fellow believers, and that is to enjoin the good and forbid the evil.
Which is an example of that.
This is really the heart and crux of what we're seeing here, because this polarization, there's a legislative, a ruling bylaw, divine law, that says, okay, you can be a good person, you believe in the truth, that's great. God says that's wonderful. But when you see your neighbor doing something, or your friend, or your brother doing something I forbade, well, it's your job to go and tell him not to do that. That's hard.
Yeah, because
your brother's not going to like you for that.
Well, it could be that when you say to somebody, please don't do that.
Oh, or your father, for example.
Or whoever.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
Obviously, they're not going to like it.
They're not going to like it.
If they're into doing that.
Yeah.
Or if they feel like, who are you to tell me?
Yeah, exactly.
They might even know that it's not good.
Yeah, I mean, especially in societies where, you and I have lived. in Scotland, for example, I know that if you say, Jim, don't have a drink, you get punched in the face.
Don't say it.
But you don't say it.
Right, you don't say that to Jim, right?
But don't say it to Jim. But, if you say it to Abdul,
yeah,
you've got a point,
Exactly.
So this is the whole point, isn't it? That when we get down to the crux of the matter, this Amr bin Maruf is a very important duty. And this is one of the things that, that even when we discuss Ashura, when we discuss Muharram, when we discuss, these great changes, these great events that change the course of history, this is the hardest principle on which to act upon as a believer. And this is the test. I mean, that's what we're talking about here, because this is the real test.
So this is the deal. Actually, if you read the Islamic government, Hukumat-e Islami Velayat Faqih, by Imam, it's a very good book to read. It's not simply a legal treatise.
No, it's not.
It's
no.
more than that.
Oh.
He talks about the fact that we were beset in the Muslim world by what he called, or the way it's translated, is pseudo-saints.
Pseudo-saints,
yes. In Farsi, it's khushk muqaddas.
Right.
Which, if you want to translate it, very literally, is dried-up holy person.
A dried up holy person.
Right. A dry holy person.
I've heard of dry apricot, but
Basically what he's trying to say is that it's this fake holiness.
Sure.
Don't get involved with politics.
That's right. It's trying to
don't get involved with politics.
Exactly.
Be nice to everything. If the Shah is coming, go kiss his hand.
Yeah.
Because hey, he is the Shah and you're part of And there's that famous story.
Mm.
Again, we're talking about Imam Khomeini and his personality.
This is the late 50s.
And the Shah announces, I'm coming to Qom to have a meeting with the ulama.
Right.
because I'm the Shah, I can do this.
I see.
And they all have to attend.
All right.
Okay?
Fine.
So this is the picture. Imagine this.
Sure.
So the Shah rides into, well, figuratively speaking, you know, with a car. He was a car. He drives into Qom.
Drives into Qom.
Which is, you know, at that time, maybe 2-3 hours from Tehran with the roads and the cars of that time, right? Mm-hmm. And he enters the room where all the main ulama are seated.
Yes.
And as Iranian custom, as Eastern custom, they all get up.
Mm.
Except who?
Imam Khomeini.
Exactly.
God bless his grace.
Exactly.
What a man.
And I just something popped in my mind right now. It's the reverse thing what Shaitan did.
Mm.
Who, when God said, bow to the Imam of the
very
age.
Very good point. Excellent.
He didn't bow.
Mm.
This is Imam doing the reverse.
Verse.
Which is the guy who comes in and he says, you know, King of Kings and, you know.
The axis
of time, you know, Qutb-e Zaman and whatever. All
sure.
the things that the Iranians used to call their kings.
Yes.
He doesn't stand up for it.
He doesn't stand.
And, you know, it was a scandal.
Mm.
It was a scandal. Everybody's like, oh, my God, you know.
Mm.
Ayatollah Khomeini didn't stand up for, you know, the king.
Yes.
you gotta love him.
He was doing the right thing.
He's like, you know what, I'm not going to stand up for the king.
Yes, and what are the other ulama doing? You know, I mean, did he pass something in Qom for which they should be standing up for?
Right.
You know?
So
I mean, this guy was, you know.
So,
yeah.
The point is that obviously doing things like this is going to upset some people.
Of course.
Even people who are quote-unquote religious.
Ah.
Even people who are quote-unquote, you know, whatever, we live according to Islam. Well, part of Islam is that you don't.
Do
show respect to somebody who is a zalim and who kills people and who tortures people and imprisons people without...
Yeah, and doesn't deserve that kind of respect.
Right.
Exactly.
Okay?
Exactly.
Right. Yes. And they say, well, what about... Isn't he also just a human, the king, you know? Isn't he just deserve that normal, basic, you know, thing that a human does? Well, we're like, well, no. Once you do certain things, you...
yeah, I mean, once
you're disqualified from that...
You're disqualified from that list. From God's...
It's not that he's not human. It's just, you know, you have to act human.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's not like you're physically a human being, therefore, you know, you have to act like you.
And if you're a fasik, then, you know.
Fasik is fasik.
Yeah, you're out.
Okay, maybe. There are certain things that are no longer. And we're not talking dry, you know, legal aspects of things.
No.
Okay?
No.
So, we have this person, Imam Khomeini. He does these things from way back.
Mm.
We're not even talking.
No, it's not even. Yeah.
I'll give you another example.
Please.
This is during his, I think this was in the 30s or 20s. I'm sorry, 30s or 40s.
Sure.
They're in Fezziyeh, and some mentally deranged person comes in with a knife.
Yes, he was going to stab the imam.
And they were going to stab different, he was going around threatening people.
People.
So most of the ulama, they fled.
Mm.
What did imam do?
He slapped him.
He gave him a big slap.
Slap right in his, and the knife fell from the hand, and the man was shaking.
Right?
Mm.
So, oh, this is not appropriate. You know, if somebody is threatening a Rouhani and, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
What should you're a Rouhani, you're a cleric, and then somebody is threatening you with a knife. What's the, you know, the pseudo-saint way of reacting? Is to just, you know, fold up and be like, oh, please don't kill me, or my son, you know, go ahead and take my life. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Right? So, but what's the real way? What's the real answer?
Is to give him a good bloody hiding, as we would say in Scotland.
Right?
Yes.
The whole story with Jim and Abdullah, right?
Yeah,
Abdul,
yes,
right?
Exactly.
Right?
Because the thing, you know, quite rightly so, because, I mean, here's a...
That's what a holy person, a real holy person
does.
Okay? Because the guy is going to damage himself as well.
Exactly.
If he stabs somebody, he's going to have to be punished. He's going to go... So, Imam, I'm saying this as an example. People are like, oh, you're mythologizing him and turning.
No,
it's about what is your reaction when a real thing happens in your life.
Sure.
Okay?
And this required decisive action. I mean, the thing is that let's not even... I mean, you mentioned that example, and I thank you for that. And, of course, you know, this is all to the credit and greatness of Imam Khomeini, because now we realize what kind of personality he's going to become later on. But, of course, you know, we see this with the prophets as well. I mean, Prophet Moses punches a guy and knocks his lights out,
right?
Well, I put that in, you know, in the nicest possible way I can.
Right.
But he killed him.
Right.
Right? And this was one of Pharaoh's soldiers, one of his guards, right? And that was a serious offense. I mean, that was the death penalty, you know. And that's what I'm saying. I mean, there's a precedent for this. Exactly. This is what real men do.
Well, the point is that when you stand up for truth,
yeah.
this polarizes people.
Sure.
This repulses some people.
Mm.
Okay?
Yeah.
And that's what a really saintly person does.
Exactly.
Okay? Especially in, you see, this is the beautiful thing about Islam, which is different than the other things that the other religions have become.
Exactly. These sort of pseudo...
Okay. Right. The ideal, for example, in some of the Christian churches has become to, you know, be a monk.
Yeah.
Or be some sort of a recluse or be a celibate.
Exactly.
Which
exactly.
is they say, you know, you like in the Catholic Church. Yeah, yeah, like yeah. in the Catholic Church, you yeah. can't be a priest unless you're celibate.
Yeah.
Which, you know, there is a history of fighting and soldier and priests going to war, but it's not the dominant vision of what a thing is. Okay?
Yes, exactly.
Or, you know, in certain Eastern traditions where it's like, you know, you got to renounce the world and whatever and
yeah,
all that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not the truth.
No, it's not.
That's not the truth.
No.
Okay? So we have a person like Imam Khomeini who is the embodiment and manifestation of his teachers, which are the Ahlul Bayt, which is the Prophet, peace be upon him, which is Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Sure.
And I would say that even among the Imams, you have a very special, obviously we always say that Imam Ali has the top position among the Imams.
Of course.
And he's also the one that is the most... And we're not talking about what's going to happen with the zuhur of Imam Zaman. We're
no.
talking about those that we've experienced. He's the one that is the most, you know, attracting and repulsing of all of them.
Sure.
And there are many, many stories of him, you know, in the early history of Islam. And so I'm not going to go through all of them.
No.
But I'll give you another example of Imam Khomeini. So
please.
We were talking about this previously where, you know, he flies into Tehran after years and years of exile.
Yeah.
You know, in order to lead the revolution. And he's at the airport, I'm sure you remember.
Yes.
And, you know, they bring the children's choir, and they're singing that beautiful, you know, choral.
Surud. Yes.
Surud that about Imam.
Yeah.
And, you know, very emotional.
Yes, it
scene.
Was. It was a
you
very
know,
emotional
people
scene.
Were losing it.
Yeah, losing
people were crying.
Yeah.
And
yeah, absolutely.
Imam, not a flicker of a muscle on his face.
Face, exactly. exactly.
Totally. Okay. Then the reporter says to him, oh, you know the
yeah.
Eastern kind
yeah.
of
yeah.
style of like, you know, so after all these years
yes,
of,
yeah.
you know,
mm.
What's your feeling about, you know, coming back to your homeland? And he just looks at him and says, nothing.
Yeah. Heech.
That famous Heech.
That
right?
famous Heech.
Right. So
that caught the BBC by the pants, as they say.
Right.
You know, it really.
So
know,
obviously people are like, what does that mean? He's a holy person. Shouldn't she? You know, people are expecting him to give like some long, Hafiz poem about, you know.
Yeah, Hafiz poem or something,
right.
you know, something
right.
mystical
right.
about
it's
his
like
return.
Some, you know.
You know
and
the rise of a phoenix or something like that, you know.
You know, phoenix rising out of the ashes.
Yeah, exactly, out of the ashes
you know,
or something.
Like,
you know?
That's what they expect.
They expect, exactly.
Because
exactly.
this is the cultural thing that they think
absolutely,
is going to.
Absolutely.
And his whole thing is, it's not about this.
It's not,
it's
about,
not about, you know, this kind of rituals. It's not about the, it's about the reality of things.
Exactly.
Okay? What's your feeling about him?
Nothing.
Whether I'm there or here.
Live with it.
Well, what is he saying? Let's think about this for a second.
Yeah, exactly.
He's saying that it doesn't matter where I am in the world.
World. Exactly.
The world is not that important, actually.
No. No.
Okay?
Yeah.
Whether I am, you know, in exile, you know, in
yes,
difficulty, or whether I'm the leader of a nation.
A nation, that's not
what's
important.
What's your feeling? Nothing.
Nothing.
That's the goal. Is that it shouldn't make a difference.
And it make a difference.
Whether you're the leader or not the leader. Okay?
Fantastic.
If you're the leader, you have the same feeling as though you were, you know, some respectable old cleric, you know, sitting in his home giving lessons to his
students.
Yeah. Okay?
Sure. Fantastic.
And this is the test that Allah wants from us. The things I'm saying, obviously, I'm not applying to myself because I fail in all those. I'm trying to simply understand what a person like Imam Khomeini, who in our time was really the closest we had to, you know, that masum guidance that you could see, you know, with your own eyes. At least in
absolutely.
My at least in my experience,
absolutely.
You know, whatever. I think a lot of people feel that way.
Yeah, I
so
feel
we
that
see
way.
This is his deal. He's like, it doesn't matter. I've you know, there's millions of people waiting in the streets to greet me, and you know, I'm not impressed by this, which is great. You know, it's fantastic. Right?
It really is. Yeah.
Right?
I mean, it was a big eye opener. I mean, as
it's
you
fantastic.
Say,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
So he goes to Beit Zahra.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's, again, very emotional, even more so emotional than you know, at the airport, because we're going to the graves of the martyrs. The martyrs' families are there.
Yeah.
And then they sing that song, that poem, which is, you know, just thinking about it, you know, sends shivers down my spine, you know?
Sure.
It's the surud about the shuhada.
Yes.
And everybody knows it in Iran, and it's just, it's an amazing poem.
Yes.
And if you and if you look at the film, everybody is crying.
Yes.
You know, his son, Haj Ahmad, is crying. Alayna Ternuri is sitting there. He lost his turban.
I remember the film. Yeah? Yes, I remember.
Everybody's film, crying.
Crying, yes.
Everybody's crying.
Except
Imam. So, you know, in an Eastern emotional society, like...
Yes. And where the Imam does get emotional is the point where he says, I'm going to smash this government in the teeth.
Exactly.
And that's what it's about, mate.
Listen, and this is the thing for them. They are shocked. They're like, oh my God, a cleric.
Yeah.
An old 80-year-old cleric. Mm. Isn't he supposed to be the one that, you know, oh, let's invite Aghay Bakhtiari and let's invite so-and-so and let's get it together and let's come to some, you know. And he's like, no. This person who is the prime minister is not legitimate.
No.
Because the person who appointed him wasn't legitimate.
No. Absolutely.
Right? Because they said to him, they said, again, we're repeating some of the history, but I think this is very good
very important to
see what a personality of a real holy
person is like.
Because they said to him when he came to Iran, I mentioned this in previous programs, sure. I want to repeat it because I think it's a very interesting story.
Sure.
They said to him, you know what, fine, the Shah has left, Bakhtiar has taken over the government, why don't you just go back to Iran, go to Qom and, you know, be the Ayatollah Uzma.
Yeah.
Do your Ayatollah Uzma thing.
And leave
and let Bakhtiar do the government. Every now and then, if you really think a red line is being crossed, issue a fatwa. Well, we'll live with that.
We'll live with that.
What did he say? Oh, and then they threatened him. It was a thruffer, right?
Yeah, it was a thruffer, yes.
They said, and if you don't do that, we will tell the military to conduct a coup d'etat, and they will arrest all of you and execute all of you.
Yes, and he said, I will declare.
He said, and this is the Americans sending him this message through Ibrahim Yazdi, who was leader of the Freedom Movement.
Freedom Movement,
you know, had good connections with the Americans.
Sure.
Because of his time living in America and being a U.S. citizen.
Sure.
Okay? So, at that time, through Ibrahim Yazdi, they sent him a message saying this. What is his response?
I'll declare jihad.
I will declare jihad.
Yes.
What did Kissinger say?
He said something we don't understand.
He said, we don't understand what he's... from where he's coming from.
Coming from, right. Exactly.
He's
using religious terminology and religious...
it's not something we learned in Harvard.
It's not something we learned in Harvard,
right. It's not something I can teach at Harvard to the kids, you know, about, you know... It doesn't fit to the 19th century, you know, European balance of power state model, okay?
Yes, exactly.
He's from another time and place. We don't know what to do with him.
No.
So, here's a man... He says to the Americans, hey, you do this, it's jihad.
Mm-hmm.
He comes to Iran. How do you feel? What's your feeling?
Heech.
He comes to Beit Zahra.
Yes.
Doesn't cry when everybody, the whole nation's crying.
He doesn't cry.
And then he says, you know what? I'm going to suck this. I'm going to punch this government to the mouth.
Mouth. Because it's not legitimate.
It's not legitimate. And with the help of the people, I am going to establish a government.
That's where he was very passionate.
I, as a religious leader, not I as a man personal, whatever.
Yes.
Me as the head and, you know, top legal scholar, I'm going to establish a government. And we're going to have an Islamic Republic.
Problem.
Although he didn't mention Islamic Republic in that.
At that time, but of course later on that was the case.
So, all this stuff, completely against the grain of, you know, Eastern culture, Iranian culture, whatever, even certain other things.
Mm.
You see this with Imam Ali alayhi salam going completely against some of those Arab, you know, customs.
Yes, in a very
that tribalism.
Yes,
that tribal favoritism with your tribe, with your family.
Mm.
You know, all those things that, you know, you would that really are a way of preventing haq, of preventing the truth happening.
Yeah.
This famous example of when his cousin wants money from Bayt al-Mal, which we mentioned before, program.
He put a hot pebble in his...
Yeah, he had, you know, he couldn't see very well, Imam Ali alayhi salam put a hot coal in his hand and said, said, this is, feel this is hell when you take money from
from Bayt al-Mal.
Right?
Yes.
So people think, oh, that's very harsh, that's very, you know...
No. No, that's not harsh.
He's just telling him, he's getting to the point.
He's getting to the facts. That's going to happen anyway.
Right. So he's getting there quicker than maybe somebody else.
Somebody else, yes.
And this is the same with Imam Khomeini.
Sure.
He came, he did the things that he had to do, he was successful, and that's why, you know, tens of millions of people loved him, and tens of millions of people hated him. And Allah likes that.
Allah likes that. Thank you very much. On that note, sir, thank you very much indeed for the contribution for the man who changed the world. And it just leaves me to thank our listeners and to say, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
French artist has created a huge cardboard installation in the shape of a hanging bridge. The artwork is 18 meters in length and hovers above Rome's Tiber River with the help of three gigantic helium-filled balloons. Olivier, who created the work, was inspired by famous Italian Renaissance architect and sculptor Michelangelo. The Italian master had been tasked with the constructing a bridge on Tiber to connect the gardens of the Villa Farnesina to the Farnese Palace. However, he died before he could complete the venture. Now Michelangelo's mission has been accomplished centuries after his demise by one of his admirers. Every year, a lot of animals lose their life due to various kinds of accidents, but some of them are lucky enough to get a second chance. Perseus, the Greek cat, is one of them. The stray feline was taken to a vet in the city of Larissa last year after a terrible accident. The vets had to perform three surgeries, but Perseus lost the same number of limbs. However, he managed to stay alive and was given prosthetic legs. Perseus has adapted perfectly to his new limbs and now uses them to get around. He has also managed to snatch the heart of his saviors as visitors at the clinic where he cured have grown. A Japanese art collective has created a mesmerizing environment in a forest where nature and technology come together. In the mountains of Kyushu in southern Japan, the nature comes to life after the dark. Flowers and trees are illuminated in a glowing ripple shine, while rocks turn colorful with light installations. A waterfall made of light pours gently on a bright rock. Some rocks have calligraphy, and artificial pond projects colorful fish too. The artists behind the work say their aim is to unite technology and nature.
The thing is, sometimes people think it's a digital and nature is completely against each other. But in the same time, we think it's in the digital and the nature is quite easy to merge.
The Japanese team also wants to raise awareness about the original beauty of the nature, which they say is often ignored. To remind people of that, they hold exhibitions combining projections, sound, and carefully designed spaces. So far, the group has organized several art shows of this kind. Animals have been providing protection and service to people since time immemorial. They have not only been the source of food like meat, butter and milk, but also served humans by eating plants toxic to them. Authorities in New York City have taken 24 goats from a nearby farm to the Riverside Park in Manhattan to munch on invasive weeds. They say it's an environmentally friendly win-win for the species removal at the park. The goats get to feast on overgrown Bush and Riverside Park Conservancy doesn't have to dump harsh chemicals on weeds. Park officials say it's both healthy for the goats and good for the environment.
As part of our woodland restoration initiative, 2 years ago, we unleashed a very hungry group of goats into a stretch of the park that had been overrun with invasive plants. And wow, did they exceed expectations. We called it Gotham because we put the goat in Gotham. They chowed down on Japanese knotweed. They noshed on porcelain berry. They snacked on multiflora rose. They easily traversed the hard-to-reach terrain behind me and gulped down poison ivy without even giving it a second thought. Since goats are naturally effective weed whackers, putting them to work in Gotham is like treating them to an all-you-can-eat buffet. It's healthy for the goats, and it's good for the environment. That's farm to table.
People visiting the goats at the zoo say these animals are emotionally intelligent and connect with people. Goats are an ingenious approach to weed removal, eating species dangerous to humans like poison ivy. Of the 24 goats, 5 will call Riverside Park its home through the end of August. For some others, the public can vote to determine which goats will be crowned the greatest of all time. The winner will be announced by the end of the summer.
Singapore unveils one of the world's biggest floating solar panel farms in a bid for quadrupling its solar energy production by 2025. The farm is as big as 45 football fields. It includes 122,000 solar panels. The panels are designed to last for 25 years, and drones will be used to assist with maintenance. The farm is located on a reservoir in western Singapore and will generate enough electricity to power its 5 water treatment plants. It puts Singapore among the few countries in the world with a water treatment system fully powered by green energy. The farm can reduce Singapore's carbon emissions by 32,000 tons annually. Floating solar panels perform up to 15% better than conventional rooftop panels. That's because of the cooling effect of water and that shading from other buildings does not affect them. Singapore is currently developing 4 other floating solar panel projects. Maybe kittens are considered the cutest baby animals by many of us, but just wait to see this baby hippo, which was born during a full moon. The male calf was born in a Mexican zoo last month. He weighs 30 kilos upon birth. Since then, he has spent most of his time bonding with his mother. The vets in the zoo say he is healthy, playful, strong, and a bit hyperactive. They say some of his habits are surprisingly similar to that of a horse or a dolphin. Generally, reproduction among zoo hippos is not a common practice. Therefore, newborn calves are signs of high quality of the lives and habitats of their parents. A zoo in central France is welcoming the birth of a male giraffe after 15 months of waiting. The calf is named after Melman, the giraffe character in the Madagascar movie franchise. He was born on Sunday in a Beauval Zoo park. He is 170 centimeters tall and weighs 55 kilograms. Zookeepers say Melman is a special baby.
A giraffe birth here. It's our second birth since we've had the group of females established for a few years. So for us, it's still quite an important and exceptional event because it's not every day that we have a giraffe birth.
The giraffe keepers say Melman stood on his feet for the first time 45 minutes after being born. Since zoos have opened in France, visitors can enjoy seeing little Melman playing around with his mother. The birth of the baby giraffe is good news for wildlife preservation, as according to estimates, the number of the animal in the wild has dropped by about 30% since the 1980s.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
The issue of marine trash has long worried scientists and environmentalists. Now a French engineer has invented a robot to help clean ocean waste. The Jellyfish Bot is a remote-controlled, electric-powered boat that helps clean rubbish from the surface of the water. It's 70 centimeters long and 70 wide, almost the size of a suitcase. The robot can collect everything from plastic bottles to masks and even oil and petrol. Despite its wide-ranging utility, Jellyfish Bot has a rather simple mechanism.
To collect trash, you have to do something as simple as possible, because otherwise, if we put too complicated mechanisms, it can get blocked and things can get stuck in the system. We designed the robot with a slide mechanism that goes towards a net, so we fill up the net, we take back the net, and that's the end of it.
The trash-collecting robot is being used at around 15 ports in France, lightening the workload of local cleaners. It has also been exported to countries including Japan, Norway, and Singapore. The makers have also developed an autonomous version of the boat.
Malaysians at a vaccination center in the city of Kuching have witnessed a surprising scene. A T-Rex turned up to get his COVID-19 jab. Fitness instructor Kenny Sia dressed up in a dinosaur costume to amuse people, doesn't he look fabulous, and protect himself. Sia said he made the decision to lift up the spirits of frontline health workers, is exhausted by vaccinating over 5,000 people a day. People rushed to take pictures with him, hailing his appearance and historic and funny. A giant 3D cat has risen to fame in the Japanese capital, Tokyo, bringing joy to citizens amid the COVID-19 pandemic. A massive billboard featuring the cat has been installed in one of Tokyo's busiest districts. The realistic-looking cat on a 4K resolution screen appears every few minutes between advertisements. Depending on the time of day, the cat appears differently and sometimes meowing at people walking by. The companies that set up the billboard hope that they can cheer people up during the dark era of the coronavirus pandemic. The display has already caused a frenzy in the city and among the social platforms, with many expressing joy and amazement at the technology.
Peru is full of natural wonders worthy of appreciation in each of its regions. A zoo in the capital Lima has now unveiled an incredibly cute and adorable Andean alpaca calf to attract visitors amid dwindling zoo-goers due to the coronavirus pandemic. This furry baby alpaca named Paquita is just 1 month old and was introduced to the public on the eve of the 200th anniversary of Peru's independence from Spain. The zoo has also displayed its families of llamas, alpaca, and vicuña. The three are members of South American camelids biological family and are traditionally valued for their soft and warm wool. They live in the Andes Mountains, which lay thousands of meters above sea level. Peruvians are proud of the history of wools associated with these species, which have common ancestors with camels.
Four German tightrope walkers have set a new world highlining distance record by crossing an Arctic valley in Sweden. The group tiptoed a distance of more than 2 kilometres between two mountain peaks in Lapland barefoot. The line they walked on was set at a height of 600 metres. The four members of the team walked the line one after another successfully, despite challenges including the wind and long distance. It took 2 days for the team to rig the line between the two peaks.
A herd of elephants migrating in China have been making headlines for months. Now they have once again attracted attention. Experts monitoring the animals this week noticed two females engaged in a dramatic fight over the herd's leadership, where they kicked and bit each other. The tussle soon ended after a male elephant succeeded in calming the belligerent giants. The fight happened in China's southwestern province of Yunnan. The herd embarked on a lengthy journey last year after escaping a nature reserve and has since trekked hundreds of miles. The elephant's migration is the longest one in China's history. A distinctive feature, no matter of humans or animals, often catches our attention. You might have heard stories about the big fat cow or other animals you love the most. Here we bring you a story about a cow for her not being big, but for being the smallest. Rani, a 23-month-old cow, is being reared on a farm near the Bangladeshi capital, Dhaka. She is only 20 inches tall and weighs 26 kilograms. Local vets say the little Rani has no physical problems, but will no longer gain any weight or height. The owner believes Rani is shorter than the smallest cow in Guinness World Record. The record for the smallest cow so far held by a 4-year-old red cow named Manikyam from the Indian state of Kerala.
We found on the internet that the smallest known cow is living in India's Kerala, which weighs 40 kilograms, but ours weighs only 26, so we believe ours is the world's smallest. That's why we applied to the Guinness World Records. They replied to us saying they will investigate within 90 days.
The tiny cow has also caused tourist frenzy in the South Asian country as thousands are flocking to Dhaka to take a glance despite coronavirus restrictions. The owner says over 15,000 people come to visit her in just 3 days. The dwarf cow has also gone viral on social media. A nearly 22-meter-high sand sculpture in Denmark has set a new Guinness record as the world's tallest sandcastle. The sculpture has been constructed with nearly 5 tons of sand. It's made in the shape of a triangle, and a wood structure stabilizes it. More than 30 artists from different countries have worked on the project, carving intricate details on the castle's wall. Its makers say a nod to the coronavirus pandemic was also made at the top of that construction. They say that's because the virus has controlled the lives of people over the past months. The sand piece broke the previous Guinness record that belonged to an 18-meter-high sand castle in Germany.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're with us at Islamic Upbringing at IRIB English Radio. We're talking about how the perfect or ideal upbringing can be provided to children, and it's based upon the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah, which has been compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. We talked about a specific question in the previous program, which was about entertainment, and I'm going to just read the question for those who just joined us. It was, how do you deal with boredom at home when children don't have anything to do and they roam around the house all day? And we did address Brother Miqdad, actually. I'm going to welcome him to another program of Islamic Upbringing. Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
So the question, as we just mentioned, was that, and we did discuss activities that can be set up, creative ones, and that can involve them fully, limiting screen time, but also providing them with enough screen time. And other things that you might see fit to add, because there's probably a lot more than just what we discussed in the previous program.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, in addition to what we talked about in the previous show, we can add a few things. One of the things that's very nice to do, and you'll find perhaps a little benefit in that, is to involve children in things that are happening at home, right? So whether it's cleaning, whether it's cooking, whether it's some DIY work, whatever the parents are working with or working on, then involving the children actually would be a very beneficial thing. Children would enjoy it. It will become a good activity. It will get them out of their boredom. It also teach them new things as well. So if mom is cooking at home, for example, she's making a meal, then involve the child. If you have a daughter who's 3, 4, or if you have a son as well, you can ask him, for example, to pass you the flour or to break an egg, for example, or to add a bit of salt. And whilst you're doing that, you're talking to them about the recipe, about the different ingredients in the recipe, about the importance of eating healthy. Basically, children feel involved in what they do as well. And then when you present the meal at the end of the day, you can say that the daughter cooked it, for example.
Well, so my 2-year-old, she cracked an egg, and I had been chewing on the eggshell for quite a long. So, yeah, that happens, but it's all right.
Yes. You know. Same, for example, if the dad is working on I don't know, in the shed, making something, DIY work, for example, involving your children in that, children feel very happy, they enjoy spending time with their parents, and they feel happy that they're actually beneficial to them as well. They're helping out. They feel, and then often you realize that once they've got this amount of time with their parents, they got this amount of feeling happy of helping out, they'll just take something from there and then move on to something they can play on their own for some time. Especially if they have siblings, then you'll find that the helping part will very quickly move on to a game, a role play game, or a kind of a creative game, basically, and you'll see them busy for quite some time after that. So this is one thing that we recommend a lot, is to get the children to get involved with you, whatever you're doing, and then slowly so you'll see that they'll move on and do their own things.
So as you're young, you always want to be a grown-up, and this actually helps them feel like a grown-up, you know?
Yes. And what happens also, it really helps the role-play games. So role-play games are very important in a children's life.
Do you give them the roles, or they decide themselves? We're going to address that after this short break. Please stay tuned, dear listeners. And we'll be right back.
Hey, stop! I got a
IRIB English Radio presents a priceless gift to parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5.
and they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this estrave to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back to Islamic upbringing. We're talking about children and how to keep them entertained. And we mentioned that a child, when you give them the responsibility or involve them in whatever you're doing, they feel a part of it, and eventually they drift away in a positive manner, and they start involving themselves as siblings or even as an individual, and they keep themselves occupied, and that's for quite some time, as you mentioned.
So, we stopped at, I mentioned role play games, basically. So role play games is when children pretend to be other people, either their parents or their friends or a particular role that they play off somebody, basically. And through that, there's a whole imagination of stories that happen. These kind of games are very useful and very important for children. It builds the imagination. They learn through this a lot. Maybe we can talk about role play game in another show, but you find that role play games last quite long as well, very often, especially if it involves a lot of children when they get together. But you see, role play requires for them to have seen something real, for them to replay it in a role play game
or modify it.
So, and this is where involving your children in the things that you do, so whether it's cooking or cleaning or working or writing or painting or drawing or DIY work or whatever it is, basically, when they feel involved in the real world kind of thing, basically, then role play becomes very strong, and they learn a lot from that role play that they're going to copy from what they learn in the real world.
That's actually interesting, because children from a very, very young age, they realize what's real and what's not. For example, if you give your child your wallet compared to a toy, they pick up your wallet, you know. They realize that's something important, that's what I want.
Yes, that's true. They see what's real and what's a toy. And usually they go for things that are real. So this is the point about involving children in the normal, the work that the parents are involved with. To a certain extent, and this will really help their role play
grow.
Their role play grow, yes, and keep them busy for a much longer period of time. Moving on, another advice, another thing that we can do is change in the environment. So you find that children really enjoy change in the environment. So if you've had a few weeks of a lot of boredom, we don't know what to do. It's summer holidays. Everybody is bit frustrated, on edge, just roaming around the house. We don't know what we're going to do with our life. Change things around. Put the sofas on the left side rather than the right side. Move all the books around. I don't know. Place the bed differently.
And get the children involved also.
Exactly. And a complete change of scene would actually bring about new life. Would make them, first it will keep them a lot busy, right? Because it's doing things. And it would actually bring about a completely new atmosphere in the house. And this usually does help.
Yeah, even grown-ups, it helps their own children.
For sure, yeah. Now, I'm not saying you should do this every 2 weeks, obviously. Something to do once a summer, for example. Or maybe even twice a summer, but that'll be a bit more than that.
I'm probably going to do that when I go back after the show, because, yeah, I realize I haven't done that in a while. We're going to come back after a short break. Please stay tuned, dear listeners, and we're going to carry on about whatever it is that we're talking about.
Ya muqiyal khayrat, ya muqiyal khayrat.
Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam said, a child's right is to be kind to him when educating him, forgiving him, covering his mistakes, acting moderately towards him, and helping him.
Ya muqiyal khayrat. Yeah.
Welcome back to Islamic Upbringing. We're talking about entertainment for children, what role we've got to play. We left off at moving things around, which is very interesting. For me, I like that. I might not like doing it myself, you know, but I just like seeing it. But I should do it myself, getting involved, you know, not being lazy. Sorry, I drifted off. And so that's what we're talking about.
So changing the scene really helps. It brings about new energy, a new atmosphere, makes children a bit more happy, basically, and able to play a bit more on their own through because of the change. And this naturally does happen. You could go to the extent of painting the walls all over again, or another wallpaper, for example, or these kind of things. But I'm not even talking about that. So I'm just talking about simple things, whether it's changing the position of the bed, for example, moving the books around in a different corner, changing the TV settings, those kind of things, basically, small things. From that, another thing you can also do is go to the attic, or go to the storeroom or whatever you have, basically, and bring back very old things.
If you have any, yes.
So whether the things are lying in the parking, for example, having a clearing out kind of afternoon, basically, where you go back to old photos or very old clothes that you've stored somewhere in a suitcase, or very old tools that you have, basically. You know, the kind of places in at the end of the parking, for example, where it's been gathered for years now, it's time to clear them out. Or in the attic, there's things that are rotting there, for example, bring them all out. This will really actually, it'll get your cleaning done. It'll get a new kind of environment. But it also keep the children busy because it's kind of new things for them. The old things are very new things. It brings back memory. It brings back new ideas of what to do. That's an idea.
Old things might not even be... They might be new for the children because they've never seen them before because they've been sitting there for so long.
Exactly, yeah. So this is an idea where that would keep for children busy for quite a few days. And you'll find there's a lot of learning to it as well. There's a lot of discussion with the family. Oh, we did this long time ago. This will happen. It brings back memories and it brings back things that we could have... Things that we learned from our experiences. And it's a way to really keep ourselves busy in the summer, obviously through it's family time, it's communication, it's a lot of learning.
Get the children to sit around and listen, that was something that they usually would not do.
Yes.
But yeah, when you mentioned painting, I remember in our school, our teacher, she allowed us to paint our own rooms, classrooms, and I was the one who decided the colour, and that evening was PTM, parent-teacher meeting. And I messed it up. It looked horrible, and our teacher had to fix something up so that the school isn't embarrassed in front of the parents. Things like that might happen, but you know, it's worth the entertainment that a child gets while he's at it. Because you know, you can just always blame the child, and you know, oh, my child did that. Well, not blame, you know, even other people, the guests or other people around you might understand. But what's valuable is that mental growth that your child had. Are we gonna carry on with this topic? Okay, we are. So please send in your questions if it's about this topic or a completely different question that you have at englishradio@irib.ir. That's our email. And that's the same for all our social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Do follow up other episodes of Islamic Upbringing at parstoday.com, parstoday.com. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space returned upon rest.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.